healthcare reform. Today is Wednesday, March 21st. We will continue our informational meeting on the comparison of the key concepts in 329, 27, and 3368. We have, it's just really, kind of embarrassing. So we don't mind it if Janine Smith feels a little slighted, but Lori Freeman just abandoned her this evening to go do, work on some bill. I have no idea what bill she would be working on, but we are quite confident in Janine's capabilities, and so after we have report from committee staff, we will begin, continue our deliberations. We will start on page 3, public program expansion, and as you will notice, experience is the best teacher, and we will begin the slideshow here pretty soon that no one can read, but at least we've left the lights on for you this time. So, Dr. Bukovi, anything to say?
Nothing, Chair, except if we will be again going over the matrix dated 3/19/07. So members at the dais do not have a copy, we can get you one. I think we may have a few more up at the on table. And if everybody in the audience would please turn off your cell phones and chime in devices. Thank you.
Man can leave his computer on. That's, we understand. The well, that said, let's just jump right in this and continue to compare the three bills.
I got one.
Janine, excuse me. Does Senator Bates not have a copy?
No, I've got my own. I didn't come down with it. I'm sorry.
I got my notes on.
Proceed ahead.
Thank you, Chair Wesslin and Chair Bates. As you said, we were going to go ahead and start on page 3 and public program expansion. For the record, I am Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, abandoned by Lori Freeman.
Exactly. We'll all send her nasty, notes if you prefer.
No, that's okay. I know she's hard at work. So going to page 3, the public program expansion, this particular category was focused on where we're going to continue the current, what we're going to do about the Medicaid program, where it is. And in 329, we're going to expand public program as much as possible with the concept of trying to get as much federal match as possible. And that we would try to streamline state agencies that deliver medical benefits. But it would be more via a new public program. The Senate Bill 27 it also wants to expand the public program as much as possible and consider replacing Medicare in addition to Medicaid and provide subsidies and the current subsidy program for employer-sponsored insurance, which is FEOP. The House Bill 3368, which again is somewhat built off of the Health Policy Commission report, was that we would expand the current OHP and FEOP coverage up to 200%. And then, as you remember on page 2, we had talked about trying to provide some subsidies all the way up to 300%. So that would there would be a that would more likely be through an exchange. So the comparison here is, does the current system that of OHP as we have it now exist in the concepts with House Bill 3368 really building, maximizing, I think all have in principle federal maximization of Medicaid. It's just exactly how you do it is really the issue amongst the bills.
Questions in committee on public program expansion?
Yeah, can I go ahead?
Senator Morsell.
Okay. As long as we're mentioning the word Medicaid, I've been meeting with the Senior and Disabled Service, the Senior and Disabled Committee, of which I am a member, and some other groups. We had a meeting on Monday, and we're going to have another meeting in a couple of weeks, and part of the discussion revolves around the non-medical Medicaid expenditures, assisted living, and all of those other things. And there are people who are not overly apprehensive, but they're just kind of wondering if any of the shifting of Medicaid to benefits, if there is going to be shifting, is going to impact the existing programs. And I know we're not there yet, but that's a concern, and you've probably talked about it already, but I just wanted to raise that concern. And I will be at the senior, along with Liz, this Friday to talk about what we're doing here. The senior disabled, the governor's commission will be meeting on Friday, and I will be there to give them an update from my perspective, and Liz will be there to talk about the Archimedes and about this process. So just the Medicaid money that is going to non-health related programs.
Yeah, and I think the answer, a very legitimate concern, this has come up at several of the town halls. I think the answer is we don't want to tie, you know, to tie public policy hands, but I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it type of thing. I mean, they do such an incredible job here in this state. So, I mean, that's kind of where we are, and I appreciate your leadership on this, Senator Morissette, and would encourage you to sit down with Liz and continue the dialogue. Senator Bates, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The level of federal poverty in this, it needs to be, I think, just for a moment discussed and thought about. Most of us feel that once you go above 250%, you start getting something called crowd out. At 300%, you're clearly into that. But in this system, after I've thought about it for a while, crowd out is no longer a factor. Everybody's in this. We're not worried about people leaving private insurance and going to a different plan. Crowd out really isn't a factor, especially when you consider that probably above the 200% of the poverty level or thereabouts, they're going to be in the fiat program buying into what is essentially a commercial accountable health plan with an organ health card. We need to bring as much federal dollars into that pool as we can. What I've asked OMAP to do is give me an idea if you have 615,000 uninsured people in Oregon, as we do right now, at what level of federal poverty do you start capturing most of those lives? Is it at 400%, 350%? Where do you get those lives down that there's very few that aren't captured? Because the best way to bring them into the larger pool we're talking about is through a program like FEOP, where you have federal and state match, along with employer-employee contributions to supplement that premium they're going to pay. So it's another one of those things that I had difficulty with because I've been in the old system for so long, I couldn't get my mind out of the old system, just as we couldn't with pre-existing conditions. Everyone's automatically in immediately because you no longer are cherry-picking or cost-shifting. So having said that, I would like to see get an idea of where we have to go to capture most of those 615,000 lives. We know they're low income. We know most of them are working. Where do we have to go?
Yeah, Senator Bates, just from our uninsurance numbers, especially like in healthy kids, about 50% of the uninsured are below where about 200% and 50% are above, and the adult numbers are somewhat similar. So if you're trying to reach out to the uninsured, you're going to get about half of the uninsured under 200%. And the other point is that when the Policy Commission discussed this, is Massachusetts was able to get a waiver for Medicaid match up to 300% for adults, which is first time. They had sort of stopped at 200 prior to that. So when the Policy Commission was discussing this, they wanted to try to maximize match as far up as they could, but felt that maybe the traditional Oregon health plan style delivery of that would be stopped at 200 and then just subsidies to some sort of more private market model from 200 to 300 and then full buy-in above that.
Follow up. If you went to 300% of the federal poverty level, do you have even a ballpark idea of where you would start impacting the line as far as 615,000 are concerned? You're talking at 400,000, 500,000?
Yeah, I'd have to look back at our uninsurance numbers, but I could get you those kind of what our ballpark you know, would you get two-thirds of the uninsured if you go to 300? But we always thought the subsidies would only go that far. And then, and also the other thing the Policy Commission did was affordability. After about 300, they felt that people could afford to pay full price if you could have a reasonable price package above 300.
Considering what the price of a premium is nowadays, I'm not completely convinced that's the case. I'm just not. We need to look at that. And I'd like to get those figures as quick as we could, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on paid public or public program expansion? All right. Roll the employer.
Roll of the employer. We had talked, I think, last time about sort of the role of the individual in terms of a mandate and participation. So we were trying to capture in this one kind of what was the mandate or, and you can't really use that word, but more the requirement or participation of the employer. And in your conceptual draft, you felt that private and public employers could buy into the program using their particular contributions, and you could purchase supplemental on top of your essential benefit package. Senate Bill 27 sort of reconsiders whether benefits need to be tied to employers, in that employers, that everyone would in the state would get this basic benefit package regardless of who they work for, but then employers could purchase supplemental on top of that. And then in 3368, again, it's just sort of the we would be maximizing Medicaid as much as possible, and then there would be this exchange, and employers would be encouraged to provide insurance, feeling that they both there needed to be some sort of encouragement. Massachusetts actually has more of a stronger worded version, and that they could, by pooling together, could get those prices down for employers to purchase something for their employees. And that there would be a in Representative Greenlick's bill, there'd be an excise tax and apply for tax credit reimbursement. It was a way to get around ERISA in terms of not mandating participation, but that you would get kind of credited back, and it was a broad-based tax.
Yeah, I think there are some subtle differences between 329 and 27. 3368 is, while there's some similarity, it's kind of a different animal altogether. And I, for one, think it's something we should, at least in regard to the exchange or the connector, it's something we should work in to the bill. Because I will tell you, one of the things that this connector gets us, we're referring to it as an exchange, one of the things this gets us is it gives us some an immediacy into dealing with the uninsured population we have today. I mean, healthy kids notwithstanding, which needs to pass, and hopefully we're going to get that. Okay, what about the adults? And we've got to be conscious. And I think this is a step in the right direction. I think it has some things lacking, but in terms of getting immediate coverage for a greater number of those individuals not covered in healthy kids. I mean, healthy kids is supposed to cover some standard population adults as well, and that's a very good thing. But I think this gives some additional coverage to Oregonians that would otherwise not have it. So I think there's some value in including this in the combined bill. Senator Morsette.
Thank you. I said last time, and I will say it again, I think the exchange is the ideal model to use, because it is a pooling device, and it has employers, it has everybody putting something in, and then it's distributed according to the need, and it just seems to me like it's the right place to have that mix, and it does involve public-private, and I think a very efficient way. So I really like that concept.
I think one of the keys, and we all talk kind of in terms of where we are now and where we're going to get to, and we leave this critical component out of there, the transition. I actually think Senate Bill 27 better addressed the transition than 329. But I think the exchange is an excellent transition vehicle. Representative Cannon.
Thank you. I just House Bill 3368 envision a employer-based system of insurance. So my insurance would be tied as it is today to my employer, and if I lose my job, I fall onto the public resources insofar as they're available through this program.
Oh, well, some of the Representative Cannon and committee, some of the advantages in how Massachusetts looks at it is that you actually can use it as you shift between jobs. If you're part of this pool, you're part of a merged sort of pool rating, and so it actually allows some portability as you shift jobs. You might be able to keep the same plan if various employers are all buying in, just the way the connector is set up in Massachusetts.
Sure, but if I lose my job, then that's a
different
story.
You could still participate as an individual,
right, okay,
in the connector model.
But we can do that today in Oregon for, what is it, 18 months? If you can,
Cobra.
Yeah, Cobra.
Yeah.
So I see where you're going.
It's just very expensive. Cobra is very expensive,
right,
and what Massachusetts is trying to get at, and the sort of the thoughts behind the connector model is that it's a way to make it a more affordable portability than what is currently available in traditional portability these days.
Yeah, thanks.
Like, regular employer-based health care isn't very expensive?
Well, no, it's expensive, but then when you have to pay the full price and your employer stops paying.
It's very expensive.
It gets more expensive.
Plus.
Yeah.
The other issue I might raise, though, here is that whether you would want to have, as Massachusetts has sort of chosen to do and what the Policy Commission was sort of advising, was do you make it more... What's the employer's part of the game? You have this. If you go for an individual mandate, is there some sort of employer requirement to participate or not? And that's what House Bill 3368 was trying to get at, some teeth in the employer part versus 329 is a little bit more voluntary participation. And so the question is whether you're ready to decide about some sort of employer-like mandate or requirement.
Yeah, I'd like to apologize to the committee, that very loud distraction that just came in the room and sat in the back row is Robin Henderson, mental health director for St. Charles Hospital, and so I hope that wasn't too distracting to any of you all. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Where does the small business person, including a sole proprietor, fit into this from the employer point of view?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, the exchange model is really designed to help facilitate getting assistance to the small business owner to buy affordable insurance for their employees. So it's kind of, the connector's focused on both individuals and small business. I'm thinking that the large business have a lot of clout already with large numbers to be able to do a lot of things, and they've got large HR departments. Some of the features of the connector are really to kind of be a one-stop shopping, a way to get to these accountable health plans.
Follow up, please. This is not a matter of... Okay, every business person or entity, small business, would contribute in the exchange part, even a sole proprietor.
Senator Morissette, I think that's up to you to decide
how you want to set that up. Is that the way the model was set up? In the healthcare advisory committee. I don't have
in
that.
Health
document.
Policy Commission was thinking that they would, that you could participate in the connector, and if you and or offer your own insurance, and either way you would get, if you're offering insurance, then you got a reduction of the or a rebate back on your excise tax.
Okay. I have a friend who is a sole proprietor, and he feels that he's kind of falling through the cracks right now for business insurance, and that if he had two or three people, it would be in a different category. But
the connector also is a pooling mechanism to try to make it so that sole proprietor would have a little more purchasing power by collectively purchasing.
Okay. But a sole proprietor would not be any different than an individual without insurance, would it, or would it?
Actually, at least in the Massachusetts model, it's that there's small groups and individuals. Individuals could be a sole proprietor, or an individual could be just you, someone who wasn't running a company, and they're treated as a group of one, and they get a merged pooling rate of, they put everybody in one pool to get the rates developed. So they've sort of merged their individual market and their small business market in Massachusetts.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to follow up question a little bit further. We had a presentation by Joe Ariel from DCBS and a discussion of what that would really mean for this state. He was optimistic about certain parts of it, that it would mm-hmm. have some value, but it wouldn't have huge value. There's a big difference between the market in Massachusetts and in this state, that getting individuals and individual companies or companies with small numbers of employees into a group market would have some value. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't going to be dramatic. It's still something we should obviously be doing. So there's a little bit of caution there. My next question, though, is can the exchange be utilized to get people into the FIAT program, which is substantial, mm-hmm. and we've worked hard and not been successful in getting the group market going, so 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 employee group into FIAT. We've had a hard time converting that over.
Senator Bates and the committee, the way the Policy Commission was talking about it is that, you know, of course, you can't take Massachusetts and make it work here. They want to try to find the best of all these plans and make it work best here. We'd need to look at those kind of details, and you'd probably need to really decide what was the best part. But then there's probably a need for some sort of subsidy, and whether you subsidize via the way we do it in FIAP, which is a percentage of premium, or you could do what they're doing in New York, Healthy New York, where they buy a certain portion of the risk and do some reinsurance to bring the price down. You get a certain amount of savings by pooling, but you also may need to do some other things to bring the price of that premium down. And so there are some other ways we might need to look to, be it either just continuing like a FIAP-like subsidy or a reinsured product or some other measures to try to buy that price down.
Moving on.
Okay. So moving on to the last of page 3 is the health plan carrier requirements, and that was trying to see what kind of functions here were going to be required of the health plans. And in your bill, the trust board would set the rates. They would ensure some of the activities of the plan in terms of not denying enrollment to anyone holding a health card and having a defined set of essential health benefits with defined exceptions and limits on cost sharing. The Senate Bill 27 sets the rates also to the health plans, contracts, including some standards regarding quality, performance, and transparency. And must use community rating, no underwriting, and use defined benefits. So a lot of similarities. And your bill also captures some of the quality and performance stuff in kind of another era of your bill. And then House Bill 3368 talks about the role of the exchange in terms of defining some affordability and benefit package standards. It does the contracting and helps develop some of the products and looks at costs and quality.
Do we have any idea what the form of a excise tax would be and what kind of revenue it produces? We should point out, too, this is a House bill, so they can do this stuff. We can't.
Oh, okay. You mean in the previous column when it said 2% excise tax? There is, we had John McConnell price out that it would cost with some rough costs, and I think that's where Representative Greenlee got the 2% that it would help to offset those costs to get the whole thing going. But I don't know off the top of my head what 2%.
Is that just for running the exchange? Is it for making a Medicaid match?
Actually, I think the numbers that John McConnell Dr. McConnell was how much would it cost for us to maximize Medicaid, put our part of it in, and how much more then for the exchange to get up and running and doing all this and some assumptions around some of the exchanges.
That was wrapped into this then.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So further discussion on the health plan carrier requirements?
I don't see any. Let's move on.
Boy, we're whizzing tonight.
And just so the committee knows, I've taken pretty careful notes on this and another matrix we're working off. We're having LC drafting a combination bill that will have all three of these pieces in to a great degree. And so what I'm hearing here in committee is last week, on Monday, what we're hearing tonight, I'm taking that down to LC. So your comments are being recorded by me to make sure we get down there with them. So what you're saying here is important to me. I don't feel like you have to hold back saying anything. Go ahead.
Okay. On the top of page 4, the next column was financing. Again, with your since these are two of these are Senate bills, they are somewhat silent on the exact financing, but yours talks about a pooling a variety of funding sources, employer-employee contributions, individual premiums, federal funds that can be made available either through match or other means, and state appropriations to create the Oregon Healthcare Fund. Senate Bill 27, somewhat along the same lines, with the addition of a specific Medicare and the tax exemption of employer-paid benefits from the feds. Additional revenue may need to be determined, and the benefits would be adjusted if the money allowed, but the reimbursement rate for providers and plans would not be reduced if there was a need for adjustments in you did not have adequate funding. House Bill 3368 goes into, as we were talking about, an excise tax on wages that would be administered through the Department of Revenue. And as we mentioned before, some of that would be reimbursed back to participants in the exchange if they're providing health insurance for their employees.
If this doesn't generate a conversation from this committee, then I know everyone's brain dead tonight, okay?
I have my hand up.
You guys had an exceptional day in the House, I understand, today.
Yes, it's a long day in the
House. Yes, you know, from my point of view, it's, you know, if you've raised children like I have and you're in a restaurant and one of them's acting up and you decide to put them in the car, it's a great idea, except that one of the parents has to go with them. Okay. And sit in the car when the rest of the family eats. So I think that was kind of what went on over there, David.
You're welcome on the House side anytime, Senator.
So sometimes humor can make it less painful. Representative Cannon.
Yes. Was it discussed, or does 3368, which I haven't read, does it specify how much of that, or anticipate how much of that 2% excise tax goes back in the form of credits to companies that provide insurance? Is there some guessing on that?
I don't believe the bill specifically outlines how much goes back. I'd have to look exactly, but it was the idea, at least around the policy commission, was there'd be this broad-based tax, and if you as an employer were providing insurance, then you would get the rebate of that tax back to help offset your costs. If you weren't providing care, then the 2% would be to help cover those participants in your employment to make sure that they still got something through the exchange.
And this is how Massachusetts, well, part of how Massachusetts is financing.
Well, Massachusetts has a variety of means of getting some dollars together. They have some other funds that they had, some disproportionate share hospital dollars and a variety of other funds. But they have a $350 per person penalty, and I think we talked about it on Monday. And then if your employee shows up at the emergency room, you're going to, as an employer, get stuck with some of that bill, and all of that would go into sort of an uncompensated pot for those who didn't have an employer paying for them to be sure that they still got access to health care.
So does it not include this excise or payroll tax?
They have a I don't think they have a payroll tax. No.
Representative Kenneth, this is a key line of discussion, and we need to continue this for a few more minutes.
Thank you. One of the things that I've always thought about, I know when Health Care for All had their initiative, It went down in flames. It was 80-20. It was defeated. And I don't know that they ever talked about the fact that any tax that you paid would be in lieu of premiums. And I would like to, you know, it's interesting to think if, okay, one thing you could say is you won't pay any more taxes than you already pay for premiums for health care. I'm assuming people don't mind paying premiums, but they hate to pay a tax. So out of pocket, you know, could be in the form of a tax in lieu of a premium. I mean, if you're going to get the coverage and you're going to get better coverage than you're getting now and you're going to spread it out, you know, it'd be interesting to know how much the employer, the big employer, pays in premiums for insurance. Now, instead of paying premiums, would they be willing to pay less than that in taxes and get better coverage? So I think when we're talking tax, we have to consider what people are already paying for insurance and kind of try to differentiate, and maybe you get a much better deal by paying taxes than you do now for paying premiums.
Senator Bates and Senator Moore said, would it be all right if I invited Nora to come
Absolutely.
Up, since she's the one who has read every single piece she could about the exchange? Just make sure I'm not misquoting.
Two more members of the House. I know you've had a long day over there. And
we did. Our committee went till 5:40.
And you had a long day in the House, too, preceding that. I'd like everyone to note that when Representative Greenlink walked in here, it was Mom, no hands. I'm glad to see you walking on your own again.
Well, would you stand up and take a bow, please?
I had my cane all day today. I got tired and used the walker, and now I wanted to walk in without anything.
Good.
Glad to see you back on your feet, Mitch.
Senator Bates, Nora has an answer to your previous question about the excise tax and how much.
For the record, my name is Nora Leibowitz.
You have to move up to the microphone.
Move the microphone to you, or
this
use
is
the microphone.
A way to torture the tall.
Yes. I do the same thing over here.
My name is Nora Leibowitz. I work for the Office of Health Policy and Research. And Chair Bates, you'd asked about a 2% tax, or someone asked about 2% tax. And what that would get, I don't have that exact number, but in the Health Policy Commission report, what we did was we started with an estimate of an amount of money that we thought would be necessary based on John McConnell's research into how many uninsured there were and what we thought that would cost. So we kind of worked backwards from his work that said it would be about $550 million to cover all the uninsured. And then we said, well, how would we do that? And we took a number of possible scenarios. So what we looked at was one option was a 0.8% payroll tax that would be paid by all employers with no credit back. A 2.8% tax that would involve a full credit for employers that were already providing health insurance. They could get a credit of equal to the amount paid in health insurance. Or a 1.5% tax for having a 50% credit for what employers had paid for their insurance. We didn't model a 2% per se. We started with the dollar amount and modeled for various options.
Wouldn't 2%, I'd say a median income of $30,000, mean that an employer would pay about $600 a year to employ?
Representative Greenlink, that sounds right to me, but
not a ton, but twice as much as $300 a year.
Let me ask a couple of questions. Senator Morris first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what does this 2% buy? Because it's not anywhere close to what's required in any kind of a sense of pooling of funds.
I might be able to help you there. Can I help you on this?
Yeah.
We did a calculation of what it would take in additional funds from general fund to get up to 300% of the federal poverty level and have something left to put into a fund to help supplement more premiums. and that number was between $500 and $600 million. Strange, you should come up with the same number. We did it a different way. That's why I was so interested in this number. I wanted to know if it was between $500 and $600 million, and it is. That assumes that no general fund is backed out. The general fund amount is the same. So you're and what it leverages for you is about $1.2 or $3 billion into the system. Not when the total package then becomes over $1.2, $1.3 billion.
If you got 50%.
That's not for everybody, though. That's for maximizing Medicaid.
Right? That's for maximizing Medicaid, which, and there was some small portion left over for people in that 300% to 400% of the federal poverty level who would still. Yeah, I'm not even sure FEOP goes that high. You've got to look at those numbers carefully, because at a certain point you're reaching an income level where people have some choices to make. If you're making $100,000 a year, I'm not sure we should be supplementing your insurance. That may be a responsibility you should have yourself.
Family of 15 making $100,000 is under 185% of the poverty line.
I will offer that. That's a choice some people make, too. maybe a great choice, maybe not such a great choice. But those are the things that we need to talk about, and frankly, the board would need to deal with, I think. But at least we have a ballpark figure for what that kind of money, that kind of a payroll tax would actually produce. I have other questions about it. And one is what the good Senator Morrison brought up. If you can get your people insured for 2 or 3%, why would you continue paying a premium for health insurance? I mean, there are reasons they do it, for to attract employees. It's a benefit for employees. But if you have another way you can go, you have to be some mechanism to prevent that kind of incredible crowd out then. Was that discussed by the commission?
We did have, Chair Bates, we did have a conversation about providing that those options and making nothing be too, I guess the concern is, and I know you all have talked a lot about ERISA, but the concern would be you don't want to do anything that would sort of force all employers in one direction or another by making it seem sort of unreasonable to choose one for fear that would look like an ERISA challengeable event. If you said, well, you can do A or you can do B and make B so much more appealing, I think it does, in sort of the scenarios that we've set up, it doesn't necessarily, there are some entities that are going to find it more efficient to do it themselves, or are for whatever reason choosing to define their own package as opposed to pooling.
I'm not talking about defining your own package or requiring them to have health insurance. I'm not saying that. I'm worried about a company that says, I'm presently paying 20% of my payroll for a health insurance plan for my employees, and I have an option now for 2% to just pay the tax, drop the insurance, knowing that they will be covered now through a different mechanism that I don't have to pay into other than the 2%.
Actually, they won't be covered under this. What you would do is force them into the individual mandate. So you essentially take away the benefit and force your employees to buy health insurance under the individual mandate.
And you pay 2%.
Not a very large penalty.
Yeah, and that's not exactly what we had in mind here, I don't think. Was that discussion?
Yes, sure. It was discussed, and in fact, it's sort of a it's one of the issues that has come up in Massachusetts, and one of the biggest kind of returns to that that discussion is that if you're an employer who has employees that are in a competitive field and you're concerned about attracting them compared to another employer, that you're going to want to provide good benefits to get those employees. And although it's theoretically possible that all the lawyers, all the law firms in Oregon will say, okay, we're all going to drop our insurance, it seems like they're unlikely to, because they know that whoever doesn't is going to get the best staff.
And also the commission thought that Massachusetts was even lighter weight on that. I mean, with them only requiring 350 a year per person, it was the various scenarios were attempts to try to get a little more teeth than Massachusetts had, but there's still those concerns.
I'm actually more concerned by an example of a couple of big box stores, one that does not supply health insurance for employees and one that does, and that the employees are working at or just above minimum wage. And we're trying to get the big employer that doesn't have a premium they're paying, doesn't have health insurance employees. We're trying to move them towards that in any way we can. Because the other entity is going, hey, we're carrying your people through the cost shift on our premium. This would seem to me to tell the employer that has a lot of low-income individuals working for them, I'm doing my 2% and get out. And it might incite this one to go, if I have to stay in that playing field with them, I don't have people who are in my employ that are highly trained, but it's good jobs, and we're going to eliminate that as a benefit because there's really nowhere else for those people to go, and we know we can do this.
Mm-hmm. And the only other thing to note, though, is that Maryland tried hard to do that and try to get the big box that wasn't paying to do it, and theirs did not meet ERISA and fell apart. So
no, I'm talking about the person who has the insurance already saying, we're going to drop it and go to the 2%. That's what I'm worried about, not the other way around.
That's not an ERISA problem. It's not actually different than today, because right now the firm that is providing health insurance is at a competitive disadvantage to the one that isn't, and if they're all asked to pay a payroll tax, they've all paid the same level of tax.
And my point is, that is the way it is today, and we're losing 4% of that market every year. The employer who has the health insurance and is paying the health insurance, we're losing them at 4% a year. That's exactly what's going on. That's what we want to stop. Okay? You're right. It's exactly what's going on.
Well, it's just
let's not make it worse by giving them a better out.
Dollars back instead of not.
Yes.
Okay. If
here and then there.
Okay. If there is an employer with 500 employees and they pay X number of thousands of dollars a month or whatever, and they go into the exchange, are they still dealing with their 500 employees, or are they putting X number of dollars into the exchange that will be used to cover everybody? And they're going to get a better deal. They will pay less than $50,000 or $20,000 in premiums for their 500 by going into the exchange and pooling their money and providing coverage for other people, but they're going to get a better deal.
Depends on how.
Okay,
you
so
that.
What do they put? What do they put in the exchange? Now, would they put the equivalent of their premiums into the exchange, or would they would have to get a better deal? Now, what happens to the employers who don't insure? I think there has to be a penalty. They have to pay something into the exchange for employees that work for them to even the playing field. But it's got to be a better deal for the people who are currently paying those premiums.
I would not disagree with that. Mitch, and then Senator Morris.
Yeah, I mean, remember, 3368 is an attempt to mimic the Health Policy Commission. The Health Policy Commission looked at it two ways. Starting with Massachusetts, the notion is you declare it's everybody's responsibility. There's an employer mandate and an employee mandate. And then, in order to get it signed by a Republican governor, or in order to get it vetoed by a Republican governor with the idea that it would be overridden every wink, wink, there would be this sort of token penalty if you didn't, as an employer, provide health insurance. And there were different models that we looked at in the commission, including the San Francisco model. How much was that?
It was a lot of money, right?
Yeah, I forget the exact amount.
A couple $1,000 a year. I mean, you know, or maybe
a more significant penalty.
Maybe a more significant penalty. Or you can go the other direction, and somewhere we're going to have to really start talking about a payroll tax that's real, where we say there'll be a payroll tax and it will really pay for everybody's health care. So that right now you and an employer are paying 10-12% on your payroll, will have a 15% payroll tax. Your employee will pay 5%, you pay 10%, and everybody will get a health insurance benefit out of it. And you won't have to worry about the prices going crazy every every year. That'll be a sort of fixed thing. Now, that's just a big jump for us. I mean, the notion that we can actually pass that on a state basis, I don't think anybody in the commission really thought you could. I mean, it just wasn't feasible. So the question is, how far can you push the token amount? And 2% came out. That came out in a meeting. I wasn't there, but it could have been 3. It could have been 1.5. I mean, it could have been some amount. But it amounts to only $50 a month for a median income employee, and amounts to only $20 a month for a minimum wage employee. I mean, it really is a token. But you would be collecting, say, from Walmart, as an example, you would be collecting a couple $100 a year, or maybe on average $400 a year, assuming there was some other, that would go into some pool to help do something, which you weren't doing now, and their employees would be clearly eligible for financial assistance. A minimum wage employee is going to be eligible for financial assistance under the individual mandate. And something would happen, and you would expect Intel would say, oh, okay, well, we're providing health insurance, we'll take the money back that we can get, and it'll go to our bottom line, and that's nice, but we're not going to change our health insurance package. And Nike and OHSU and PEB, and I mean, you expect they're just going to keep doing what they're doing and then not have to pay this penalty. They'll have to pay the penalty, they'll get it rebated.
I would hope that'd be the case.
You would hope that.
Maybe it would be. And yeah. Don't get me wrong, I happen to like this
maybe
kind
would.
Of plan.
Maybe
I,
it would.
I think exchange and a payroll tax's nature to help fund the Medicaid program and bring out that federal match is a very elegant way to do it. I'm doing the devil's advocate here to a certain degree. I'm just worried about the erosion of the commercial market, and we don't want that accelerated. We want it stopped and reversed.
You see, you're not going to get that all. You're going to end up waiving that for a lot of employees.
I understand.
So okay. You can't multiply that. I mean, I don't think you'll get $500 million a year out of that. If you don't have crowd out. I mean, if you don't have crowd out, the big payrolls won't include that.
Senator Morris.
Isn't this where 3368 materially departs from 329 and 27?
Yes.
And we
can't do that with a Senate that has to start in the House.
But it is materially different. And I guess my question is, given the nature of the discussion and the amount of time we're spending on this 2%, does it have any application to the concept of pooling? Because we're talking about serious assessments for a payroll tax, which if an employer is paying 20 to 25% of their payroll today for health care, that's what's going to go into that pool.
I think there is a connection, though. When you talk about employer and employee contributions, how are those contributions made? And one way of doing it, potentially, is with the payroll tax. Another is like they've got in Massachusetts, where there's a token payment of, I think, $350 per employee per year, if I remember right, in that neighborhood. There's ways, different ways of doing it, but there is a connection there. This is just much more explicit, and I appreciate the fact that it is more explicit. We have something to really look at. That's different. More discussion on 3368, because there's a lot of discussion to go on with 27 yet.
Well, I guess I have reservations along your lines, Chair. The $550 million figure came from trying to understand the cost of covering all of the currently uninsured, maximizing our federal match and covering those 600-some thousand Oregonians.
No. It came from only maximizing those eligible for Medicaid. For fully blowing Medicaid to get the other $1.2 billion or whatever it would get.
No.
Okay.
The $500 million was not to cover people above Medicaid. Right? I think that's
right. Yeah, we did some numbers in the same realm, completely separate from you, in a different way. What was interesting was the 2 to 3% came up with the same number, That number is what we needed to get to 300% of the federal poverty level. We did it a different way, came up with the same numbers.
It's the same guy that gave it.
Yeah, and probably. very likely. But we had a little higher number than that. It was 3 instead of 2. So there was money left to help supplement in a different way for people coming through an exchange. So it,
a little more.
It's 6 1/2 dozen the other. And, you know, we're talking the same realm here, so we know what we're talking about. And it, you know, assume, we weren't here, Mitch, but assume no change in the fund.
I think my point is the same, which is just that it seems probable that a lot of employers with trying to compete in very competitive industries and very competitive markets, and knowing that there is a sort of public backstop, will give up the premiums they're currently paying for their employees and pay the 2% instead. I think that just it seems quite likely. And I also recognize the fact that, you know, we're here to innovate, and we might, you know, have to. Nobody's done this. Massachusetts is trying. We don't have a lot of evidence from what's happened yet, and I'm certainly interested in hearing more conversation and speculation about it. But it seems almost inevitable that a lot of that's going to happen.
Another factor involved here is one that it's unmeasurable, but I want to mention it at least. For the most part, we're talking about small employers, people probably less than 50 employees. And for those that already have insurance for their employees, they are not likely to drop that insurance unless they absolutely have to and are forced out of the market. They have a relationship with those employees that it's hard for us to put our finger on, but it's very real. And when we took testimony for last year from small employers, over and over again we heard, we want to maintain health insurance for our employees. We can't do it with the present system because of cost, but if you can bring that cost under control or even level it off, we can stay in the market.
Yeah, and I think the exchange could help that.
Exchange and this, because this would take some of the cost shift away from them by maximizing Medicaid. It took a great deal of it away. If that was actually reflected in lower rates, that made through the system reflected in lower rates, it'd be a real value. And so, you know, we have a tendency, I think, to sometimes not really give employers the credit they are due for trying to do the right thing, because a lot of them are really trying to do that. In my particular office, as an example, if I were to pull that benefit from my employees, I probably wouldn't make it out of the office alive to start with, okay, but I just wouldn't do it. I couldn't do it, and I'd go broke before I tried to do that. And so that is something that's unmeasurable but very much there. And I think maybe that's what the Health Policy Commission was thinking about, listening to and hearing about, more than likely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can't quantify that for you. I can't. But I know we're losing the market, but maybe if we stabilize the market and actually start bringing rates down, or at least leveling them off,
right,
people will not leave the market.
And Senator Bates, I think the commission would, you know, between improving the quality as well as, I mean, providing an affordable product, it's that's the purpose the exchange would provide, is not just an excise tax to recoup some penalty, but that really it's trying to stabilize the market and market organize.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm a little confused with how we can conduct this conversation about money when we have no idea what the benefits are, and discuss that employers wouldn't leave their current plan when we don't know what the option would be that they'd be leaving for. I mean, if there's dental and optical, and, you know, if it's the Oregon Health Plan Plus, which has much better benefits than most small employers can provide, to say they'd probably just stay where they're at, I don't think gives them a lot of credit for intelligence. And I think that it's just very difficult to conduct a discussion on what kind of money will be brought in and how much money we will be spending and all that when we haven't any idea of how much we're going to be spending per patient or per insured, because we don't know what the benefit package is going to look like. And so, I mean, it's kind of interesting to kind of theorize, but I don't see how we can really get serious about talking about what kind of money it's going to take, how much money we're going to be covering or who would be covering and so forth, if we do not have any idea of what the benefits are going to be.
I don't think 3368 has a minimum benefit package, does it? I mean, it didn't before the last time I saw it.
I'm just throwing that out as we discuss.
I think your language was a benefit package that managed care, quality, and cost in Section 3 of your bill.
As a minimum.
May I respond, Representative Richardson?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I call you Dennis in public?
Please do.
I think you're absolutely right. Okay, and we know on the Medicaid side what that would cost. We're pretty sure if you produce this much money, we have a darn good idea what it is because we know what the benefit is, and you're right there. But I think what you're driving to, and I think you're correct, how do we know what the reaction to or what the what employers will do when they're looking at some kind of a payroll tax, paying a premium at the same time, and have a benefit package that is significantly lower or different than what the Medicaid population receives? And what does that premium they're now paying buy them when the alternative is to go to a pool if you qualify for it and get your employees into that pool? I think that's the point you're driving. I think it's a valid point.
It is. Plus, if we're talking about having a minimum benefit package which is less than what people get who are on Medicaid, now you got a whole new set of problems because, congratulations, you can pay for yours and you'll get less than those that don't pay for it. And I think that may get a little pushback as well from private sector.
I mean, frankly, I'm already getting pushback when people tell me my taxes go to this program which has a better benefit than what I can afford for myself and my family. So that's an issue that we need to deal with as far as benefits are concerned. I would offer that the best way to really deal with this is not to try to settle it in a legislative session. We're not going to fund the pool that I think at this time, but to have that be a function of that board to report back to us and really get some hard numbers on what a benefit looks like that's more uniform and what that benefit would cost to fund, and then we can really have a conversation whether we're willing to go there or not.
Yeah, these are most decidedly conversations for the very issues you bring up, Representative Richardson, safe harbor discussions. Those safe harbors are created in the bill. I mean, this is a legitimate topic of conversation. That's why we put it in here. There's a tremendous amount that would go into this. We could talk about this piece from now until the day after we sign he died. Senator Morsef.
Thank you. One thing, I don't know if we've talked about this, but employer rebates. I think the employer, are the employers going to keep their same insurance companies, for one thing? Are they actually going to go into the exchange, and are they going to be dealing with the same company? Secondly, are they going to be dealing with their entire package as it is today, and are they going to save money by going into the exchange? If there's a total savings as a result of this, I could see rebates going to the employers. The other part of it is some of these would be buy-ups. And the employer would, some companies, some unions negotiate better deals than others. Some employers give great benefits. And there maybe has to be a line drawn between what is a buy-up? What is it, if the employer wants to pay additional premiums or additional money into the exchange for the current benefits, that would have to be differentiated. And I don't know how you promise something on future impact, but it just seems to me that there would be room somewhere for a rebate to employers who are willing to take the risk. And the payback would be that not only would rates not increase significantly the cost of insurance, that's what we're promising as a result of this program, but there could be some savings in the program that could, after costs are covered, go back to the people who are paying the major amounts. So there, I think for the major employer, I don't know if you could convince Intel, Nike, and some of these companies to do that. But it just seems to me if they are getting a better deal with the amount of money they're paying in, that's the incentive. And with the idea that there may be some rebates when the program is a successful program and shows that, if they have that kind of trust. But
Mr. Chair, can I answer the question asked before?
If you look at section 9 of 3368, it basically says the Department of Human Services shall provide public subsidies for the purchase of health insurance coverage provided by public or private insurance, including but not limited to FIA. And it refers in the next section to the public subsidies applying only to health benefit plans that meet or exceed the basic benchmark health benefit plan established by OPHP. So basically, we're saying almost any health insurance plan that at least means the lowest benefit FIA plan, which is a pretty minimal plan. I mean, we made a decision not, you know, to say if you think you're providing health insurance, you're providing health insurance. And we put a very low bar into what that is. I mean, this is not for everybody. This is saying if you want to get a subsidy, here's what the program looks like to get a subsidy. So
are the mandates in it? 31 mandates?
No, the mandates are not in the basic FIAP, right? This is the FIAP for individuals, and it's a very stripped down plan.
Thank you. It's pretty simple.
And now I'm going to stop talking because I have to.
Keep their applause down, please.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple. You know, at the end of the day, if we can't lower cost, improve quality, and provide, you know, 100% access with a robust and fair benefits package, we don't have a package. That's the end of the day. Any other comments on financing?
Mr. Chair, we didn't have a chance to look at Senate Bill 27. I don't know if we want to do that tonight.
Oh.
I would like to make one thing clear about this 27, if I could.
Go ahead.
There's two pieces in Senate Bill 27 that are quite dramatically different than either of the other proposals. One, of course, is obviously Medicare is involved here. In Senate Bill 329, Medicare is also mentioned. Here it's explicitly brought into the pool. The other thing we see here is tax exemptions of employer and paid benefits. If you read Senate Bill 27 carefully, which I did not do initially, but it was pointed out to me, it says capture the value of deductibility. Capture the value of deductibility. It does not say you end deductibility. It says you capture the value of that. And I'd offer there's several ways of doing that, one of which, frankly, is a payroll tax. Deductibility is a benefit that it goes primarily to upper-income individuals, lower-income individuals who do not have health insurance don't get that deductibility. There's been a recent change at the federal level, I know about this, but even so, if you can't afford the premium in the first place, you don't get the deduction. Payroll tax, on a percentage basis, goes a long ways to capturing the value of this. So I want to make sure everyone understands Senate Bill 27 is not talking about ending deductibility. It's talking about capturing that value and getting it into the pool. And there's a significant difference in understanding that language. And frankly, I missed that the first time I read it. It was pointed out to me recently. The other issue is Medicare, and that's a thorny one we're going to have more discussions on, I believe. I think it's a very thorny one, and that will be discussions around this billing for the next several weeks. Medicare, we know, is ultimately going to be an unsustainable program. The question becomes, how and when and where does that discussion take place? I feel very strongly it should take place at the federal level and not even be discussed at the state level. There's others that feel differently about that, and that's going to be a key discussion for this committee to deal with, I believe, in the next several weeks.
Mr. Chair, in the course of that discussion where we're dealing with Medicaid and Medicare money, Medicaid money, Title 19, also includes money for long-term care, and it has many different aspects to it, and it looks, when you look at the numbers that have been proposed in Senate Bill 27, like it's all of the money. And so what do we do about making sure that we're not going to divert the money that's going toward long-term care and its various programs toward health care? Because, I mean, obviously that can't be done.
I understand. Thank you.
We'll just leave it at that for right now. We gave an answer last night in one of our town halls, talking about are we going to dismantle the long-term care DD system.
So repeat the answer.
Alan was actually quite articulate. He said not. I was a little more long-winded. I said absolutely not. It's that simple. Yeah, it's one of the things we do really, really, really well in this state. What's the committee's pleasure? At 6:30, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 more categories to push through. I'd like to finish this tonight if possible, but if I know the House members have had a fairly long day. We empathize. Trust us, we've all been there before. You want to get through the rest of these? I think that'd be appropriate tonight. Everyone feeling okay? Time constraints?
Are House members okay with that? Mitch?
When you average Ben's age and my age and Dennis's age, we're young enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, he wasn't referring to this Ben. I mean, you know, that's what's got me kind of steamed. Yeah, I got that figured out right away, Mitch. Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead. Cost containment mechanisms?
Cost containment and quality initiatives. And this one, we were just trying to capture some of the essence of some of the recommendations around cost and quality. In 329, there's the defined set of essential health services that has some cost controls. There's some public oversight, consumer choice and competition. Anyway, Section 4 has lots in 329. If you look at 27, they have five subcommittees that will detail the structure of the delivery system, including setting some policy standards for quality, transparency, and accountability, as well as performance measures, and through contracting with the private and public healthcare organizations of defined services, they would also set standards for quality, performance, and transparency, and including transparency of cost, charges, and outcomes. The House Bill 3368, again, talking more about the exchange itself. There's some certain regulations for the individual and uninsured health insurance consumers. There's some language in there about reducing the uninsured, which is an essence of the other two bills as well, that would reduce the cost shift. It authorizes some language around DHS to not have prior authorization of drugs, and then there's a creation of a quality institute to improve data collection. There are more flushed out recommendations within the Health Policy Commission report around quality and transparency that aren't totally captured in 3368.
Sarah Morris.
This, without a doubt, is the Achilles heel of healthcare reform. When we talk about proven methods of benefits, delivery, payments, cost shifting, in order to sell this, we have got to provide better definition with some assurance that, in fact, we will have the ability to flatten this, substantially flatten this medical inflation curve. Otherwise, this reform is going to have some very, very tough sledding.
You know, I think this section is a superb example of where all three bills come together. I think 329 has more immediacy to it in setting up the board now. I think 27 correctly articulates the need for the safe harbor discussions, and the exchange concept, which is not in any way mutually exclusive, actually addresses, Mitch, one of your big concerns, which is trying to get, you know, uninsured people more connected, excuse the pun, you know, sooner rather than later. I think this is just an elegant example of where all three of these bills, you know, in their own ways, are right on target. So, anyway, Senator Bates.
I couldn't agree more with you, and I especially like the way 27 is very specific about setting up specific committees, and I'm trying to get a flavor from the committee on this because I'm trying to take some of this information to LC. I also particularly like in 3368 the creation of a Quality Institute to improve data collection system transparency. This allows us to see if the system is working. I would offer also, though, that if you read the Institute of Medicine's exhaustive work on how to control costs and bring costs down, and if you look at those organizations which have actually done that, are primarily the self-insured, such as Intel and Fred Meyer and groups like that, who have actually kept their costs down between 6% and 8% increases over the last 3 or 4 years, when everybody else had double digit. They really did emphasize preventative care and taking care of chronic disease, which is what 329 directly speaks to. To make that kind of a change in the system may be difficult, but it's not impossible. You don't have to train thousands of new doctors. You don't have to let go of a high-tech system because these groups are working right in our state and have been successful holding costs down. Basically, the FCHIPs have been flat-funded for the last 5 years, 6 years. I think it was 5 or 6 years, and have still served the same population. So it's doable. It's not impossible. It's doable. And all three of these plans speak to it. I would suggest that if the committee agreed, we would try to weave all three of these into the bill, which we're trying to put together right now and bring back to you within the next 4 or 5 days. I want to hear if there's any disagreement with that. Anyone's really opposed to that attempt?
Chair Morse. I have no disagreement. I'm just going to reflect further on the nature of this problem within our healthcare system in the Mid-Valley. We were looking at about a 5% increase in pricing. This is a hospital, integrated system, a couple hundred dollars. But the volume, guess what? In our budget, 15% increase. So what does that tell you? What it tells you is that the cost basis is not materially increasing. It's the utilization that's increasing. But we don't have an influx of population in our area to the tune of 15%. So the utilization is up. The actual relative cost increase is fairly modest.
Mr. Chair. Question to Carrier. There are things that can change inside your population besides an increase in population. An aging population can change that dramatically, and that's something we're facing again back to Medicare. Utilization of hospital and hospital time can obviously increase if your population is aging and becoming sicker. That's a factor. And then practices in which you utilize emergency rooms are going to bring in more people to the hospital compared to being seen in a primary care home. So let me ask you, do you have any sense of those factors being part of this? I mean, there are groups that have kept it down to 5, 6, 7%. Yours, you're saying, is going to go up 15% in a rather holistic system.
Yeah, you raise a very good question. I don't know. I've not seen the demographic numbers within our area, but I would be very surprised if you had demographic changes of that would be that dramatic.
Mr. Chair, I would again say this is why we're setting up a board. That's why we're not trying to institute this program today. We're going to set up a board to really, through this organization, through these committees, to deal with that kind of a problem and see what actually works.
Universal health care or health care for all or whatever we call it will deal with illegal immigrants, I would hope, because the experience in the Ontario hospital with an illegal immigrant who came into the emergency room and ran up $1 million bill before Mexico agreed to take that person back is an example of, well, it's a terrible example of the healthcare delivery system, because that person should have been dealt with at a much lower level and could have prevented a huge cost shift to that one hospital. And that's going to get worse. And we're not going to pack people up and ship them back. They're here. They're entitled to emergency room care, and that is a large, I would imagine, a huge cost to have to absorb in any hospital. Mid Valley, Lebanon, which is part of that group, I believe that you're in. So I think that will be a huge savings. I mean, that will keep the cost down if we're effectively doing that.
Mr. Chair, along those lines, we've discussed the possibility of setting up a hotline or something of that nature to direct people to safety net clinics, legal and illegal, but to try to get them into a primary home, just as you discussed.
Good efficacy.
I'd like to just chime in on that, because to counterpoint that if the plan specifically includes anyone who lives in Oregon, including illegals, then the majority of the citizens of Oregon are not going to support it. And so we need to be careful with that. Now we have CalM, and we have FQHCs, and we have other things, but we just need to be cautious that we don't set it up in a way that you don't get federal match. It all comes out of the state, because the federal match will not cover illegals. And although it may be nice in a perfect world, according to some feelings, that you just cover everyone, the citizens of Oregon, the majority of the citizens of Oregon, are not willing to bear that expense of people that are here illegally. I just want to give a counterpoint to that position.
Any other comments on cost containment? All right. Health information infrastructure.
Yes.
All three bills.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, across the board. Good idea. Any other comments? Cost sharing for participants.
In 329, the trust board will define some affordability standards, including maximum cost-sharing levels that will eliminate economic barriers to access. Senate Bill 27 talks about a value-based cost-sharing for consumers with higher cost-sharing burdens for treatment of elective discretionary conditions and conditions that are lower on the priority list, with lower or no cost-sharing for those that are higher, particularly when the treatment is highly effective in producing quality outcome. And I think a couple sentences came out, but that the cost sharing would be adjusted to be lower for those that we know have definite efficacy versus those that would not. And then in House Bill 3368, there's some discussion about cost sharing permitted using the FEOP and the health exchange for an individual above 200%, provided it is structured in such a manner to encourage appropriate use of preventative care and avoidance of unnecessary services, and is based on an individual's ability to pay, may not exceed the cost of purchasing a plan.
Yeah, I think here again, and however this is financed, whatever that structure looks like, again, a safe harbor discussion, but the principles embodied here are that there's a cost sharing responsibility for those individuals that are capable of paying. And I think that needs to be an integral part of any of the, you know, whatever comes out of this committee. So I'm, again, nuances and differences, you know, but the principle is the same across the board. Representative Morissette.
I think that's essential, and I want to respond to our Representative Richardson. Okay.
Thanks.
It was just mentioned a few minutes ago about having a clinic near a hospital, an urgent care center. I think an urgent care center near a hospital is very important for people who otherwise would go to the emergency room. I don't know what percentage of people who go to emergency room could be redirected somewhere else. Now, the federal law says you can't turn a person away, but I would like to see alternatives, you know, so they don't have to serve everyone. Now, that doesn't deal with preventative care, which is part of the problem with having to end up in an emergency room. Even not having teeth adequately cared for, you could end up in the emergency room. But to mitigate that expense is to build in an urgent care center. Now, we have one in Eugene. I have gone to an urgent care center on the weekend when I can't get to my doctor, and they get to you immediately. there is a cost if you don't have insurance, and that's the way it should be. But I agree, we can't, we have to be careful how we articulate this package, but we have to face reality of what's already happening as well.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, when I, my only access to a physician is Dr. Bates, I go to the urgent care emergency room every time. I understand, Bill.
Let me speak this. I wasn't going to, but let me speak this real quickly if I can. There is a subtle but significant difference between issuing a organ health card to an illegal alien and at the same time saying we're not going to do that, but we are going to direct people to safe net clinics. There's a big difference. The people of the state of Oregon right now are taking care of the cost of illegals. We do it through a cost shift. We don't do it explicitly. We do it through a cost shift. So we're all actually paying for that. But there's a significant difference, I believe, and I'm going to support Representative Richardson in this, to doing the opposite, and that's offering a card. I think that increases demand, increases usage. And I think the best place for this to occur is to get them to a primary care center so they don't go to emergency rooms and give them care there, because we're going to take care of them one way or the other. Let's do it the most cost-effective way we can without encouraging excessive use of our health care system. I think we'd probably all agree to that. We also probably agree that the problem of illegal aliens in the state is not going to be solved by this state. It's going to be solved at the federal level, and they're struggling with this already. So I hope that what I've just said makes sense to you and is acceptable to you.
I think so. It certainly does, and it is what's happening presently. I asked one director of an FQHC the number of what percentage of the patients speak only Spanish when they come in, and she said about 50%. I mean, it's a reason why it's La Clinica de Valle and Garcia, and it's not, you know, Fred Zachemeyer Clinic. I mean, it is. We're already meeting it, but it's, we have to be careful how we deal with this because it's a very sensitive issue to a lot of people.
And I'm sure Representative Richardson does not mean if you speak Spanish you're illegal. Okay, he understands. I know he understands the difference.
Do I speak Spanish? No, but all my kids do. But normally when they go to the doctor, they don't practice.
Any other comments on cost sharing?
Mr. Chair, only to note that I think your depiction of Senate Bill 27 may not be quite right insofar as I don't see anything, at least on the summary, that would suggest that higher income folks would have greater cost sharing obligations under this. It is not tailored to income. There's a basic benefit which is sufficient for everyone at every income level, and if you're wealthier, then presumably you can buy up. But the cost sharing is not as depicted in 329 and 3368.
And that's exactly what I was referring to, Representative Cannon. I think there will probably be, you know, significant buy up if you're.
Actually, I'm not sure I agree with that in principle.
Daddy Warbucks. But
I mean, if you start from the principle that you might want to have a payroll tax that the individuals participate in, higher income individuals would pay more payroll tax.
And it's an excellent point, Representative Greenlee. I mean, there's a progressivity to that.
Yes, in terms of the financing, but the cost sharing, you know, what you're copay is or your co-insurance is not means-based in Senate Bill 27. It is in the other two. That was my
point. But if you're, you know, making $500,000 a year,
yes, you are paying.
Going into the pool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other on cost sharing? The one we've been waiting for. Evaluation.
Yes. With the last one.
That
evaluation.
The one I've been looking for.
You're waiting
for
it because it's last, or because that's what our office does all the time.
This is insignificant.
This is just whether the 329 is some language to designate an evaluator to see if you're going to put all this effort and money into this project to make see what happens and study the impacts. Senate Bill 27 does not specifically address this, and House Bill 3368 has our office, along with some of the outside researchers, to develop a plan to evaluate the impact of the demonstration project or program. We would still have some obligation to do some evaluation when you use Medicaid dollars, but this was to kind of specifically know and that there was a need for sometimes a more extensive evaluation than that allows.
Would we start with performance measures or wait until we've been in operation for a while? That would be kind of risky to start with a performance measure, right? But that's an evaluation tool.
Senator Moore said in committee, I think you have the trust board doing some of setting some standards and policy around what kind of performance you want and what kind of outcomes you want. This is to see if it's really working. It's like having an outsider sort of come in and say, yeah, you really did meet your you know, it's not the board itself evaluating per se. It could be an outside evaluation to see if everything's running as smoothly as planned.
Well, when you evaluate, one of the things you look at is are you doing what you said you were going to do?
Correct.
And you have to start somewhere. So you have to set goals or performance measures to start with. And then I don't care who evaluates, but if it's an outside group, that's what they look at.
Correct. I agree.
I think there's two components. Actually, I like it's a little bit of a different function. Certainly, the trust board will have to, evaluate how the system is working, measure that with some specific outcomes, Bill. But the language I like best, which was a new idea presented by the Oregon Health Policy Commission, is the evaluation of the performance of the board. Do I have that right, Mitch? Is that functionally the one of the tenants?
The point is you need somebody slightly outside of the program to do evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Janine is about as far outside as anywhere you can get.
She's not as far outside as Lori Freeman, who's not even with us tonight, doing noble work, burning the midnight oil, trying to get some bill out. I have no idea which one. Comment?
Mr. Chair, can I have some sense from the committee of what they like the best of these two proposals, or even a third proposal? I have a tendency to like 3368. I like the separation from the board, an outside set of eyes looking at this, some kind of an evaluation. I'm not sure I like the 5-year, but I mean, I think there should be evaluation going along as the board starts to function, and in fact, it goes forward with the plan as expected, and that reporting back to the legislature. But give me a sense what this committee might like on this issue, if you have a sense.
Well, I think you have to start out with some goals, so to speak, and something they can evaluate, and that's going to be the hard thing. It's risky to set a goal too early, but I don't want someone evaluating on whim. There's got to be a strict criteria of evaluation, something that everybody agrees that is a legitimate evaluation. And so I don't know who sets that, but I think it has to be in the startup of the program that in the first year, this is what we hope to achieve. It's a modest goal, and then go from there.
Senator Morris,
you can't just turn it over to someone who doesn't, understand the rules of the game in terms of evaluation.
Senator Morris said, I might turn you to Section 15 of the 329 conceptual, and there are multiple sort of parameters in which the evaluation would be. That you have language in your bill about consumer access to care, consumer access to coverage, quality of care, consumer satisfaction, consumer health status.
Yeah.
So there's some of that language already delineated in your bill presently.
Maybe bringing these two, Mr. Chair.
And
maybe bringing these two together is appropriate then. This is the group that does it, and the quality factor we're looking for, the performance measures, if you will,
mm-hmm.
are delineated in 329.
I see these as two different functions. I mean, when you need an evaluation of how the program itself is doing, and then you need an evaluation of how the management team, the board, in and of itself is doing. That's what I see the value in 329 and 3368.
Mr. Chair, I would only add that while this certainly satisfies me in terms of the technical sort of professional evaluation of the program, I would submit there's also a need, and perhaps not in statute, but for a kind of going out into the public and having a bunch of meetings at a certain point, inviting town halls, as you're doing now, to say, how is this working for you? It's submitting it to that test of the public will. And I think that in the same way that our old Senate Bill 100 set up the land use planning, or 100, 1,000? Senate Bill 100 said that one of the basic values of our land use planning system is that it's participatory and democratic, and public's going to have a chance to weigh in. That was at least the value, and we should be submitting this plan to those kinds of tests as well.
I think it is an excellent idea, and I look forward to traveling the state with you.
Very good.
Representative Ken.
Actually, based on our experience, we're appointing you as the point person.
You know, and I think you should report back to us. We'll look.
Yeah. And if you'd leave now, you can be in Astoria by 9 o'clock if you drive too fast. I think Janine had something she wanted to say.
No, I was just going to say that was all I had on our matrix, and we're done.
Nice job. Thank you.
Any other any comments for the good of the order? Any comments from staff? I think we've done great work here in the last two meetings, and as always, I very much appreciate the audience attendance. Seems like we're spending more time with ourselves than we are with our families, and that's probably true. And you know what? The good news is that's going to continue, because I mean this very sincerely. Oregon is counting on us. Oregon is counting on us. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've made tremendous progress in the last couple of meetings, and I'm very.
So, what can we expect on Monday next?
Hopefully, we don't know this. I don't want to make too hard of promises, but we'll have the draft bill out. And that's why Lori isn't here tonight. If you drive outside of the building, you will see her light on as you leave. So we very much appreciate her very dedicated work on this. That's kind of what we're hoping. Don't want to make any promises. And, of course, we'll check in with Phyllis to make sure that's okay, because we don't make a move without her. So anyway, see no other comments? Mitch, don't go away. We are adjourned.